Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
Years ago, there was a problem that if research, biomedical research, was funded by the government owned everything. They owned all the intellectual property. The consequence of which is nobody filed patents. Because why file a patent? The government's just going to take it away from you. Intellectual property was being created in the laboratories. Some of it was being classified. But for the most part, it wasn't going anywhere. It was getting published in Nature, Science, or the Journal of Irreproducible Results, but it wasn't being turned into products. So Birch Bayh and Bob Dole got together and they wrote a statute that got passed called the Bayh-Dole Act. And the Bayh-Dole Act changed everything. It's what has really driven American biotech, but it's also what's driven academia to become much of what it is right now, which is a great big money-making enterprise. And the way that Bayh-Dole works is that if you file a patent or patent disclosure as an academic, your university takes that and they make a go-no-go decision about whether or not to file a patent, because a patent isn't cheap, and to prosecute it. And if they were to file it and get it awarded, then the university would be able to sell it or commercialize it. The terms are that the investigator, the people that participated in its discovery, would get a fraction of that, often 20 or 30% of the value. The rest would go to the university. The government always has walk-in rights on any patents. And this is what's fueled a lot of the financial engine of the major centers like Boston and San Francisco and San Diego.
Biotech centers.
Now, it was also applied to government employees. And that's where you end up with this odd situation where the taxpayer is paying for the staff at the NIH and the Vaccine Research Center to make discoveries on behalf of the government that then they get paid royalties on, and those royalties come back into their departments like NIAID from the companies that commercialize the technology that they develop. And so you end up with this odd situation where the government is both acting to regulate things, and the same players that are involved in the regulation may be generating profit themselves in terms of compensation from the patent, or their institutes are getting funded.
So, I mean, that's not even a revolving door. That's just direct conflict of interest.
And it is totally legal. And at the level of the universities, you know, then you have universities interested in promoting their patents and their legal position at the expense of others. And and around it goes.
And are there patents that show foreknowledge of this pandemic that you're aware of?
There are patents. So where I'm going at is that as a consequence, everybody is super aggressive in patenting and disclosing anything that could be.
Mm.
Okay. So part of that, I know there's this whole conspiracy land about, well, this was filed at thus and such a date and that date. Now, the documents that relate to, that I haven't actually seen, but I understand there are documents that exist about establishing contracts between VRC and NIH and Moderna to make a coronavirus vaccine, and whether or not that material that was, and they predate the supposed outbreak, and whether or not those contract agreements or grants or change of money related to this specific coronavirus or to a general coronavirus, because it's been well known in the literature, as shown by that Johns Hopkins war game that happened in the fall of 2019 involving coronavirus as a threat.
It began in healthy-looking pigs months, perhaps years ago. A new coronavirus spread silently within herds. Gradually, farmers started getting sick. Infected people got a respiratory illness with symptoms ranging from mild flu-like signs to severe pneumonia. The sickest required intensive care. Many died.
We're at the start of what's looking like it will be a severe pandemic. And there are problems emerging that can only be solved by global business and governments working together.
It's been well known. You can go into the scientific literature and there are multiple people saying, guys, wake up. We've got a significant threat from SARS-related coronaviruses.
Right.
And so anybody that was in that world and in the coronavirus space would be writing every single patent they could.
Especially if they could design the virus that would create the necessity for the... I mean, I'm speculating.
So that's the loop with the gain of function. You know, the same people that are busy doing gain of function research, because that's the... So the gain of function research space is really pretty complicated and also rife with conflict of interest, as you point out. The purpose of gain of function research, ostensibly, is to foreshadow threats that might emerge or weaponization that might occur.
Do you support that the money from NIH that was going to the Wuhan Institute?
Let me explain to you why that was done. The SARS-CoV-1 originated in bats in China. It would have been irresponsible of us if we did not investigate the bat viruses and the serology to see who might have been infected.
Or perhaps it would...
But it's considered dual function because it's not only for a defensive posture, but it could potentially be used as an aggressive posture.
Right, because you have to develop the weapons in order to develop the defense.
That's the logic. And the fly in that particular ointment is that the people that I deal with are very aware that there's a huge gap in the biowarfare treaty. The Biowarfare Treaty prevents the development of lethal agents and their deployment and research into lethal agents, but it doesn't prohibit the development of non-lethal agents. So we call these incapacitating agents, things that make you so sick, give you such a bad headache, that if you happen to sniff that thing in and get that infection, there's no way you're going to be picking up your AK-47. Okay? In theory. So that cuts both ways.
Yeah.
It means that technically it's legal to develop incapacitating agents right. and deploy them.
Let me ask you something, just a kind of a cut to the bone question, if I might. Doesn't this all argue for the absolute eradication of all biosafe level 3-4 labs, all biodefense programs, USAMRID, get rid of all of that?
This is a Pandora's box problem.
Yeah.
Okay? And I'm sorry the box is already open.
Right.
Okay? And it just is. And
no way to shut it now. I mean, we've shut the nuclear box.
Sort of. But in terms of these biothreat agents, we've got new processes like CRISPR-Cas9, et cetera, that allow ready mutation and really increasingly have enabled the threat of biohacking and garage biology.
Garage biology, right. And, so that's the problem.
It's not that's not just the problem. Yeah, it's also the bad guys, and it's environmental disruption and global warming.
And it could be our own big pharma companies who I mean, but that's the problem.
It just goes on. It's the box is open. And now what are you going to do about it? So that's what I spend a lot of time thinking about when we're not in the middle of giving podcasts is how can you build systems that will allow rapid response to newly emergent pathogens or engineered pathogens? Mm. That's what Defense Threat Reduction Agency's focus is, in large part. But I believe my understanding is they've also funded some of the gain-of-function studies.
And let's talk about that. I mean, it's now sort of in the news. We talked about it with a journalist named Sam Husseini a year ago, but the whole Wuhan lab emergence possibility and its connection to NIAID and Fauci funding. I mean, what do you have any thoughts on that? Was this a more likely
so
lab
I,
or is
I haven't not a I haven't emergence? Focused on that theory, that set of theories in that world, because it's kind of irrelevant. I'm focused on trying to prevent death and disease.
Yeah.
You know, and save kids and
sure.
older people.
But I
only know the things that I can touch.
Sure. Okay.
I raised concerns about the potential engineered nature of the pathogen to my colleague in the intelligence community that I mentioned before in February, January, February. And he said, absolutely not. My people have been all over it and looked at the sequences, and there's no evidence of it having been engineered. I was assured firmly that there was no chance that this was an engineered pathogen. Mm. And yet since then, we've had sophisticated analysis that reveals things like the furin cleavage site that is hard to explain as a naturally occurring event in a interspecies crossover. So to my understanding...
Does that involve CRISPR or just gain of function?
Either one. Hard to say. Mm-hmm. I think the furin cleavage site looks like something that was transferred in, mm-hmm. not something that might have just been naturally evolved.
Now, let me ask...
But,
yeah, go ahead.
But,
sorry.
To get to your core question...
Yeah.
My sense is the preponderance of evidence is... increasingly favors that it was a non-natural origin. And I can't, having worked at primate centers, you know, it's a constant risk. My wife has worked with monkeys much of her young life at primate centers and at zoos. Mm. There's a lot of pathogens that we can pick up from non-human primates. It's a constant threat if you're a keeper or managing or doing research with those animals. Herpes viruses and others. It happens.
In terms of just a leak.
In terms of transmission to human that are in contact with them.
Right.
And the general practice in primate centers can get a little sloppy from time to time. In Wuhan, you know, it appears that the data demonstrates that federal law was circumvented by transferring funding offshore to perform studies that were otherwise prohibited from being performed onshore.
Right.
Okay, that deserves a good hard look. But what happened? I can't disambiguate between somebody slipped some, you know, post-study animals out the back door and sold them on the wet market versus somebody sold carcasses into that wet market.
Right.
Versus somebody became, one or more persons became accidentally infected with a pathogen.
Right.
Versus intentional release by a foreign party, which could be the United States, into the beating industrial heart of China.
We do sort of political economic research and you know, research into high crimes and misdemeanors. That's what we've spent our life doing. And when you see something as bizarre, as I'm sure you're aware, and you've mentioned some of the entities involved already, as Event 201, you as a scientist, what are the odds of them sitting around a table at the Pierre Hotel, Bill and Melinda Gates, Johns Hopkins, World Economic Forum, sponsoring an event where Chinese CDC, CIA, the Marriott Hotel people, et cetera, are modeling the emergence of a novel coronavirus?
This is what has been done.
In October, right before it happened.
This is what's been... So I know everybody latches on to this.
Well.
Yeah, it sure looks like a duck.
Yeah.
But I know from personal experience...
They're always
modeling. These war games have been going on for well over a decade.
Sure.
Now, and the election to focus on a coronavirus is a logical thing to have done. Does that mean that because, like I said, it's in the literature, this is a clear major threat? We already had two pop out previously, SARS and MERS. Okay, so I can't speak to things that I don't really know about directly.
Yeah.
It is an amazing coincidence. It's not, in my experience, outside the realm of possibility that this could have just been a war game.
The companies that will be our best partners of this are the companies who have been thinking about this ahead of time, who were prepared, who had redundancies and plans for their supply chains. They're going to be our strongest partners. So we are going to have to help work through public-private partnerships to support companies, but not all companies. The ones that are critical to sustaining that global supply chain, keeping commodities, people, food, other essential things to sustain the stability that we need to prevent governments from faltering, et cetera. So we're going to need much more specific information, and we're going to need a lot of that information to come from the industry itself.
The world's population is finite. We know it's doubling, you know, at this rate, exponential. We'll get to global coverage of this soon enough with some sense of cost scenario. And if we could project what a sufficient investment in Best Buys would get us in terms of minimizing not only the costs going into this, but also the accelerated uptake of the recovery, then I think that would be helpful in getting investor confidence.
Is that something the World Bank could do, this kind of projection, or is that going to require...
We do this with incredible scientific accuracy to 0.001%.
Or it could have been something more nefarious. I have no way of knowing.
I mean, the dark winter exercise happened right before the anthrax outbreak. I mean, there seems to be a correlation.
And the Kennedys were shot by the CIA, right? I mean, we could go down these rabbit holes, and you can never get to the bottom of the hole.
That's for sure.
Or
that it's just obvious. Yes, the government, the military-industrial complex definitely shot the Kennedys. Whether what angle it came from or the grassy knoll or not, who cares? It's a false mystery. This seems to me to be another false mystery. The major powers all over the world, pharmacological and otherwise, big tech, etc., the major governments, intelligence agencies, military, they have decided for some reason to move us into this fourth industrial revolution or whatever you want to call it, the Great Reset, and the virus is the mechanism to do it, and the vaccine is somehow the bridge. Now, I mean, why do you think they want every single human in America and elsewhere to be shot?
This is the great paradox that is what fuels my angst, is that it's irrational. It doesn't make good sense in terms of public policy.
Right.
It doesn't make good sense in terms of medical management. And if you throw on top of that steaming pile this clear and consistent obstructionism of alternative therapies that can be deployed early, and I was about to mention earlier, one of the huge paradoxes is why has all the money and effort only been focused on the hospitalized population? It just doesn't make sense. Okay? And there's this stack of this just doesn't make sense cards that are this high.
Yeah, right.
Right? So then that's why I was saying, you know, the government ought to come clean or not, I guess. But in the absence of them coming clean about what the heck is going on, folks are going to speculate, and that's I call it conspiracy Legos. There is a 30 or 50 different factoids that just don't make sense if you assume good faith and competence. Okay, if you start from an assumption of good faith and competence, they don't make sense.
Right,
and you can take those and assemble them into whatever castle or structure you want.
But let's think about it through the lens of incompetence for a second. Is there any Lego structure you could build solely through incompetence? I mean, you work with these people. You don't seem like an incompetent person. A lot of those people...
Well, thank you.
Yeah. A lot of the people that I imagine you work with are probably not incompetent. They're not this incompetent. They're not so incompetent that they say, you know what, shit, we don't know what to do. Let's just shut down the schools. Western civilization.
Except for what I see is repeated cascades of dysfunctional decision-making and groupthink.
Fair enough. That explains the mid-level people, perhaps. But at the top, I mean, they're not seemingly even worried about the economy, right? They're certainly not worried about the small business economy. I mean, that's being destroyed and has been. Right? I mean, all over the world. Anyway, it seems to me that the Great Reset people, who the guys who have simply pointed out what Klaus Schwab has been saying since the virus and before, have a point. I mean, the small businesses...
I don't think anyone can dispute that the logic of don't let a good crisis go to waste is pervasive. There cannot not be major economic entities, including pharmaceutical companies, that aren't saying to themselves in their boardrooms, how can we make profit? How can we exploit this? How can we advance our interests?
And could it be beyond that? Could there be something in this shot, this mRNA? I mean, we've all just admitted, no one's really looked at it besides the companies.
And the problem with that logic is, coulda, shoulda, woulda, I have no way to know.
But would it be, let me ask you this. I mean, you've heard about, for instance, the women who are having extended periods. What do you think about that?
I think that it can be explained by the effects of spike.
Spike creates blood clotting, coagulation.
And microcoagulation and contraction of microvasculature. And it damages vascular endothelium, which is going to compromise oxygenation and blood flow in placental tissues.
Great. So is that going to be good for pregnancy?
No, it's not going to be good for pregnancy. And it could explain the dysmenorrhea in part. Some of the heavy flow dysmenorrhea could be, that's often a sign of premature abortion. And in theory, there's a large study ongoing, but at this stage, even I have lost faith in the government in its ability to execute a well-controlled clinical trial.
So, but then they've just said all pregnant women should go ahead and get it.
I know. I don't understand it. I object to it. I object to this crazy push to vaccinate all the kids. It's for me, I kind of like to try to pick my battles. And I'm putting my whole career on the line here. If you read that Atlantic piece, my buddy Stan Gromkowski reprimanding me with an F-bomb in print, that I'm blowing my chance for the Nobel Prize. As far as I'm concerned, this is a hill worth fighting for. In the position that what I care about, that I hope I could bend the arc of history just a little bit with, is the children and the reproductive integrity.
The human race.
I think that's something worth fighting for, and it might still be achievable.
Have you seen the tetanus vaccine thing out of Kenya? Do you know about that?
No.
Basically the WHO, which was already in 2014, introduced a tetanus vaccine to women of childbearing years in Kenya, and the Kenyan doctors obtained samples, and because they were like, wait a second, why to just women of childbearing years? Why tetanus? We don't have a particular problem. And why is it five shots instead of three? And they looked at it, and it turns out that it contained human gonadotropin, which they determined would create spontaneous abortions and infertility after time. So that's a one of the greatest hits, you know, WHO previously. Anyway, so I mean, is there a possibility that one could, through this spike technology, create mass infertility? Is that a possibility?
Okay, so you've used a word that I have to say yes to. I'm a biologist, and I live in a world in which most things are possible.
Electroceuticals, bioelectronics. Do you know anything about them?
Are you talking about implantables and, wearables and everything else?
No, but you know, I mean, injectables.
Yeah. They're swallowables.
Yeah.
They're already used.
Right. And the head of Warp Speed was who?
Monsef Slaw.
For the vaccines.
For the vaccines. So do you know anything about his work at all?
No.
Okay. Because he was head of electroceuticals over at Glaxo. So the head of Warp Speed's vaccine program was was an injectables guy.
Yeah, so there's a lot of... So this gets back to whether or not the vaccines have an injectable material that can be used to track individuals and identify them. Right. From what I know about OWS, it was bloody chaos.
Mm.
To imagine, you know, that there was, I don't see evidence of deep thinking.
Mm.
I see evidence of a lot of chaos and groupthink and shortcuts and decision-making by committee and internal conflict. And it's hard for me to imagine that OWS yielded a sophisticated strategy for manipulating human subjects through administration of some absolute cutting edge material or implantable. What I've seen is more like Keystone Cops.
I hear you. That could have, and obviously that's at one level it probably was. Have you heard of Jose Delgado? He was a Yale scientist back in the day. He would do implantables in a crude way in the 50s and 60s.
Neurophysicist Dr. Jose Delgado was financed by the Office of Naval Research. In this experiment, the bull is sedated. Electrodes are implanted in its brain. Delgado transmits an electronic impulse to the center of the bull's brain. Delgado has remote control of the animal. Recently released CIA documents refer to the feasibility of remote control of animals and that special investigations will be conducted toward the application of selected elements of these techniques to man.
It's not your field, I understand, but it seems to me that could easily have been miniaturized at this point, and various smart particles could act as those transceivers in the same way that his body.
You're imagining a level of technical sophistication in a deployable environment that in a scalable way that I don't think we're anywhere close to.
I'm glad to hear it.
It's, you know, my colleagues at DOD would love it if we could.
Yeah,
they would latch onto that in a New York second.
So why are they trying to inject everyone?
I don't know. It is a paradox. And the easiest explanation, like I said, go back to Occam's razor.
Yeah.
Is that you've had capture of key decision makers and political players globally by the power of Big Pharma and their money. And do not underestimate the ability of Big Pharma basically to corrupt political organizations. It is profound and it is highly refined. You know how we have taken our skill in manipulating populations in political elections and we've turned it on the world, right?
Yeah.
With social media and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And we've taken our skill in advertising. And we've refined it here on the U.S. population, and then we've turned it on the world, right?
Sure.
Okay. The same, I believe, that the simplest explanation is the same basic process has happened in the pharmaceutical industry that's led to this horizontal integration, right. and coincidence of financial interests that has resulted in a propaganda and information management and political management capability the likes of which the world has never seen.
Have you seen the Pfizer contract leak?
I have seen items of that multiple contracts have been identified, and there are some of them come from kind of Eastern European countries, and it clearly documents that Pfizer has included terms and conditions that third parties looking in would say that's just not it's not ethical. It is co-opting those governments, and my understanding from colleagues in Israel is that that's essentially akin to what's happened under Mr. Netanyahu and his government, that led to this kind of odd quid pro quo, where Israel got early access to the vaccine in exchange for unprecedented access to data and protection from liability, both directly and secondarily through restrictions on disclosure of information.
Pfizer was protected from liability. What do you make of this no liability thing? I mean, it seems like the kind of...
So this is another thing, in my
ultimate
opinion, like
moral hazard, right?
Like, yeah, moral hazard, nicely put. Good choice of words. This history in U.S. history is full of these examples of unintended consequences, blowback from our decisions. And, I believe that this was something that this logic of vaccine indemnification was advanced at a time that was more naive than the present. And was there a nefarious component or a long-range strategy in doing so? I can't tell. I'm not in their brains. There has been an incrementalist expansion of that.
Of the vaccine territory.
Of both vaccine territory and of the indemnification clauses.
Right.
And I've seen example after example in the government where they thought somebody convinced somebody that it would be a good idea to do something and we would save money if we did this, or we would solve some problem if only we would fill in the blank.
Right, sure.
Right? And we would have enough vaccines and we would have vaccine innovation if only we would mitigate the risk of lawsuit.
And so the MICA Act must have been nice for you, but I'm very interested in your interaction with VAERS over the years, or especially now.
I don't interact with VAERS.
At all?
No.
So as a vaccine developer have never interacted with VAERS?
I know about it. I know about the data that are coming out right now. I've known about its limitations.
Yeah.
But it's not, I'm at the stage in the process where I'm designing clinical trials, interpreting clinical data.
And you don't do any post-market evaluation?
No, I'm not a post-market guy, and I'm not a big pharma guy. I'm not a pharmacovigilance guy.
Okay.
Those are pharmacovigilance issues.
But you have developed vaccines.
Yeah.
And you believe in the concept of vaccines, right? You're not an anti-vaxxer.
Absolutely not. I spent 30 years developing vaccines.
And have you developed vaccines that you consider successful and safe?
Actually, the flu vaccines that I've worked with ended up not being successful. Mm. The anthrax and plague vaccines, not successful.
Ebola.
Ebola would be the one example.
But you had said in an earlier interview that that the change in burial practices was more likely the cause in the reduction
for the reduction of morbidity and mortality in that West African outbreak. The data strongly suggest that it was more of a behavioral modification than a vaccine deployment.
But the vaccine, you feel in that case, did work or does have some efficacy?
Does have efficacy. It is a hot vaccine. I mean, it hurts. It causes a lot of adverse events associated with it, but in the face of... So one of the things about vaccines is that it's all about the context in which you're going to use it. If you're going to be deploying an Ebola vaccine in a ring containment situation around a village that's got a hot outbreak, you can tolerate a lot of adverse events because your risk as an individual in that environment is quite high of death and disease, and an ugly death at that. So to take another example, early on I worked with the smallpox vaccine. You remember under Cheney, there was a period of time when we were going to deploy smallpox vaccine to all first responders.
Because of the threat of a weaponization.
The perceived 1% or less threat that it might be released, mm-hmm. Okay? And I was given the task, among other things, of when it became clear that there were rare events popping up in the vaccine recipients of cardiomyopathy and pericarditis.
Which we're hearing about now.
Okay. I was asked to go back by the DOD to go back into the literature and discern whether or not those were new signals or whether those were historically positive.
Uh-huh. Like from old versions of smallpox vaccine.
Well, it was really the same product. Was it seen historically in the prior databases?
Right.
And the answer was yes.
Mm.
A small but not trivial fraction of soldiers and warfighters had significant adverse events associated with smallpox vaccine administration, which was a live attenuated vaccine, including these cardiomyopathy events.
Mm.
And they were tolerated back then because the disease was so horrendous and it was present in the population. But it could not be tolerated in the early 2000s for administration to general first responders because their true risk was virtually non-existent. So you're going to have way more disease from the vaccine than you would from the potential probable risk of smallpox exposure.
So this is very educational. So at that time, the decision was taken not to inject. And here we are tolerating, it seems to me, vast amounts of myocarditis and other adverse events.
I concur, and this is one of my core positions, is that there is every appearance that the adverse events are being underreported, and it appears that, to my assessment, because of all this messaging, things are getting more muddled now. The good news is the news is coming out. Mm. People are more and more wary. They're more and more aware that adverse events were occurring. When I had that Brett Weinstein podcast, the things I said were revolutionary.
Mm.
We were still in the land of the vaccines are perfectly safe.
When was that?
When was it? Just a number of months ago. It was like three or four.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we've come a long way since then. We're now, you know, it just getting... I knew that the cardiomyopathy and pericarditis signal existed months before it was made official.
Right.
From my colleagues at CDC, at FDA.
Mm.
So... there are many adverse events there, and I believe they are underreported, underaccounted for, and I believe there is structural bias to underreport them,
mm-hmm.
in part because the whole world has been inundated with this messaging that the vaccines are perfectly safe.
Right.
Let me give you an anecdote. I got a call after the Weinstein podcast from this distraught woman, young woman, trying to get pregnant, who had taken vaccine and had a cascade of adverse events.
Mm.
Whether or not they were related to the vaccine almost doesn't matter. She experienced these adverse events. To my ear, it sounded like they were vaccine related, but I can't say for sure.
Mm.
But she called me distraught because everybody, when she believed that she was experiencing adverse events from the vaccine, and yet everyone around her told her she must be crazy because the vaccines are perfectly safe, right? I used to say in earlier podcasts, it's the ultimate gaslighting, right? But this thinking pervades down into the level of the people that are making the adjudication decisions about whether or not something is vaccine related. They're surrounded by messaging saying these are all perfectly safe. And furthermore, they want to keep their job. They want to keep working. They don't want to generate a bunch of extra paperwork, et cetera, et cetera. I think just in terms of normal bureaucracy, there's a ton of pressure for people that are in the sector of making assessments about vaccine relatedness to discount the potential relatedness. And I think that that yielded a structural disincentive to characterize what in many cases were physician reports based on physician frontline experience in which they believe that there was relatedness between the dose administered and the adverse event. And then those were summarily discounted or disregarded as relatedness. And there were all kinds of weird criteria that if it didn't occur within, what was it, 2 weeks, then it was defined as unrelated. I mean, it's just things in retrospect that were just flat out nonsensical.
Right. Because because adverse events can occur a month or even many months, or possibly for all we know, in the case of early polio vaccines, there's some speculation or maybe some evidence.
The viral contamination. And we do know that one of the things that's happening, it's not...
Which caused cancer.
It's not one of the official recognized things, and yet it is, many, many people have experienced it, which is viral reactivation of latent viruses. I mean, walk around. For me, I go into these meetings or whatever, presentations, almost always somebody in the audience has had shingles after vaccination.
After shingles vax?
No.
After chickenpox?
After SARS-CoV-2 vaccination.
Oh, after SARS-CoV-2.
SARS-CoV-2 vaccination is associated with viral reactivation.
Along with, I have had two family members who have had appendicitis. I've had, and then I've got many friends who've had TIA. I mean, there's all kinds of people.
That's the coagulopathy problem. But
viral reactivation is a whole.
Right? So my belief is that the risks are higher than are being reported, and they're going to be coming out more and more. And they are. I mean, we now have the German pathology report. We've got pathologists in the United States that are speaking up.
Right.
I'm hearing it from cardiologists. I know a pediatric cardiologist who's a specialist in vascular inflammation in Hawaii, who is just really alarmed and upset about what he's seeing in his pediatric cardiology practice in terms of these cardiac events in young children. And we get all this messaging like, well, this damage to the heart is transient and they recover from it. Any of us that have any training in pathology and medicine know that heart doesn't recover, it scars, right? Lungs don't heal, they scar, okay? Inflammation in the brain often results in, neurofibrillary tangles and other things, scars that affect cognition. So this messaging, this almost, it is paternalistic, as if we're a bunch of children. Simplistic messaging, justified by the logic that we can't know the truth because we can't handle it if it's given to us, is just ethically wrong. And it breeds this kind of concern and lack of confidence in the whole public health enterprise. I put out this, it was on LinkedIn a couple of months ago. I made a statement, what would happen to trust in the public health system if ivermectin turned out to be safe and had efficacy and the vaccines were not perfectly safe. At the time, those two statements were highly controversial. Okay, this is only like 2 months ago. Now we look back, it's pretty well accepted that ivermectin at safe doses is safe. There's millions and millions of doses being given out.
And it's effective.
And that it has significant efficacy. I mean, I experienced it myself. A lot of people have. And it's now abundantly clear that the vaccines are not perfectly safe. And the response that I got, the third leg in that stool that I didn't mention, was the lab leak hypothesis. And now all that stuff is coming true. The responses I got at the time were basically, you know, it went viral. And there were 300 responses that in some basically all said, we've already lost faith. And I catch a lot of people tweeting and commenting that they don't want to have their children take regular standard pediatric vaccines. This is the consequence of this public policy that we've had, this messaging policy in which, you know, I'm sorry, this is a gerontocracy. The people making these decisions are rather old.
Right.
And they are 20th century minds facing a 21st century problem that they've never faced before.
Right.
And they have reflexively gone to an amazingly authoritarian, paternalistic position.
Well, listen, and that may be due to their age. It may be due to whatever agenda is going on. But certainly it seems that, yeah, we've lost faith. We've learned a lot, haven't we, about regulatory capture. We've learned a lot about how medical journals are completely bought and paid for.
The lack of courage in my colleagues.
And we've learned about that, right? Doctors are basically just, they'll read the press releases just like anybody else, or maybe at a higher level because it's out of JAMA or something. And they don't think for themselves, and they don't have moral courage, and they just go right along with it. So you have had that courage. What has happened to you since you first came out in terms of the attacks and censorship, et cetera?
So multiple specific examples. As we've discussed, I was summarily deleted abruptly without warning from LinkedIn, flushed, wiped. Of course, we had the YouTube video from Brett wiped, and Brett got deplatformed, I think largely because he kept talking about ivermectin, which is like, kryptonite to YouTube, apparently.
Right.
You know, even the mention of the word is going to get you knocked off of that platform.
Interesting.
And it wasn't, by the way, because I talked about spike toxicity. They thought that was okay. Brett made a clip of me talking about the spike toxicity. That was left on, okay, despite Reuters fact-checking me and saying that that was false. YouTube allowed that to stay on, right? So the cascade I've been through, you know, kind of the awakening of Robert Malone in terms of what the heck is going on with all this censorship stuff, and no, you're not in Kansas anymore, right? It has started with the Brett Weinstein experience and having that hit a million views and then get killed by YouTube and him deplatformed.
Yeah.
And then the Reuters hit piece. In which I was fact-checked by Reuters, asserting that what they did, and this seems to be a common strategy, they'll take your words, twist them slightly, or misinterpret them, set up a straw man, and then refute the straw man. They won't take the time, and is it intellectual dishonesty or is it intellectual incompetence? I can't, you know, we ran to Ground, who does the fact-checking for Reuters. It's a group at McMaster and in Canada, and there's another group in the UK, and they're basically at best social sciences scientists. Many of them are getting funded directly by Facebook. Many of them now, it's becoming clear, being funded by Zuckerberg Chan. They're being funded by Wellcome Trust. There is the whole Trusted News Initiative matrix. It's the best word I can come up with, and yes, I'm referring to both the movie and everything else. This integrated system. So
Reuters chairman is on the Pfizer board? Do you
right,
know that?
Exactly. I was the one that pointed that out. And in fact, that was what triggered me getting kicked off of LinkedIn, was pointing that out and raising the question, does this look like a conflict of interest to you?
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, you know, abundantly everybody said basically, hell yes. And
So has this been freeing for you, and horrific all at once? I mean, what's it like to be have the scales drop?
Well, there's this constant drumbeat of character assassination,
yeah,
by incompetent people who don't even understand the points. They don't argue against the logic. They just attack. And the favorite attack is, well, you didn't actually invent RNA vaccines. And they'll do backflips to make this statement to try to delegitimize me, never addressing the logic of what's being discussed, but only the personal invectives.